Well, I want to thank the organizers for inviting me to, and the opportunity to give a talk. All right, so I wanted to talk about quantum inequalities in particle creation in quantum field theory, and a particular problem I've been working on at the moment. So just an overview, I'll do some background information and then go over the project that I'm working on at the moment and finishing up, and then just some conclusions. And we'll see if I can actually get through 29 slides. Okay.
1 minute.
1 minute. Okay. The beginning is just review for people who already know general relativity, and just to bring you up to speed on the weak energy conditions, null energy conditions, my terminology. Thank you. We have the, in general relativity, we treat the space-time as classical, as a Lorentzian manifold, and we have the Einstein equation, which needs to be solved. And then in classical general relativity, there are a series of energy conditions which describe some of the properties of the stress energy tensor on the right-hand side of the Einstein equation. And there, some of them have names. There's the weak energy condition, the null energy condition, the strong energy condition, and the dominant energy condition. And so they basically come down to things like, if I take the contraction of the stress energy tensor with a four vector, a time-like future pointing four vector, then that gives me the energy density. And so this is basically a statement that the energy density in classical general relativity has to be positive. And that makes intuitive sense because we have no experimental evidence at all of negative mass particles. Okay. So these energy conditions were used in the classical singularity theorems of Hawking and Penrose. And they use them in the Rashaudry equation to prove focusing of geodesics. And people have worked with even weaker singularity theorems, which are averaged over a time-like geodesic. So if you take a geodesic, which is future-directed, and you do the pullback of the stress energy tensor onto the geodesic and then dot with the four velocity at the different locations, you can prove that the average weak energy condition is still enough to prove the singularity theorems. Okay. And there's also an average null energy condition. Gamma is now a null geodesic, and you have the time-like the null vectors dotted with the.
Excuse me a minute.
Yes.
What's the duration of these geodesics? Do they go from forever, forever, and ever?
Yeah, these are expected to be geodesics through the whole, from minus infinity to plus infinity. Yes.
And the singularity theorems, those include the area theorem or not?
That I don't know. I can't answer. And so when we do quantum field theory, or what in curved space-time, which is what I typically do, is that we still treat the space-time as a classical curved Lorentzian manifold. But what I want to study is the relativistic wave equations, the behavior of relativistic wave equations on this background space-time. But I want to do it as a quantized field. And so to first order, I'm actually neglecting the back reaction of the quantum field on the curved space-time. And so I'm not looking at very, very massive fields so that they distort the universe. Okay. And then we're interested in things like the number of particles created, or what's the renormalized expectation value of the stress energy tensor for the quantum field in this space-time. And it was shown very, very early on that it's a general feature of quantum field theories that every one of the classical energy conditions can be violated. And this was done by Epstein, Glaser, and Jaffe in 1965. So if I write down a quantum field theory, it's more than likely I can violate any one of the classical energy conditions. And so the question was, what do we replace those energy conditions with? Well, in quantum field theory, there are probably many candidates, but one candidate for a replacement of the classical energy condition was proposed by Ford and then proven by Ford and Roman. And these typically go under the name of quantum inequalities. And so what is a quantum inequality? Well, it's the kind of the equation over here on the left. I have my stress energy tensor operator, and I contract it with a four vector, so I'm looking at the energy density in this case. And I don't look at the renormalized energy density. What I'm looking at is the normal ordered energy density. And it doesn't actually have to be normal ordered, but it's the quantum inequalities are really on differences between two states. And so you choose some reference state, and it's often convenient to choose the vacuum state as the for the space-time as the reference state. And so then the quantum inequality takes the stress energy tensor, or the energy density here, in a state omega, and then that's the difference between the two expectation values, and it multiplies it by a test function. So it's a weighted average, and then you can, with that weighted average, then integrate from over the whole world line. And what you find in quantum field theory is that these have lower bounds, negative lower bounds. So the very first one that was produced is the, or the very first one that was derived, was by Ford and Roman in 95, and they did it on a two-dimensional cylinder space-time. And the sampling function that they use in this case is Lorentzian. And so when you, if you're trying to now say how much negative energy can you see in a space-time, well, a particular observer can only see, depending on the width of the sampling function, 1 over some constant, or basically minus some constant, divided by the width of the sampling functions, basically speaking, to the power, which is the dimension of the space-time. So here I'm working in a two-dimensional cylinder space-time, I get tau zero squared. So people have done these for two dimensions, three dimensions, four dimensions, n dimensions. And they have been extensively studied over the last two decades since Ford and Roman originally proposed these. And so naturally, the question would be, well, this is for a scalar field in two-dimensional space-time. Does it work in general and with general test functions? And the answer is yes. And so I do exactly the same thing. I take the energy density, the normal ordered energy density. I take any sampling function. In this case, I'm using compactly supported sampling functions. And what someone finds is that if you take the normal ordered energy density multiplied by the sampling function squared and integrate over the world line of a geodesic, that is greater than or equal to some function of the reference state and the sampling function. Now, one could optimize over sampling functions if one wished, but basically we typically leave them in this form unless you're after something specific. Are there any questions up to this point? Yes.
Can you remind me the definition of compactly supported? Like, I mean, what is the precise or somewhat precise?
So these are smooth and compactly supported, so infinitely differentiable, right? And they're complexly supported on the real line because I'm integrating over the proper time of the geodesic, and so that means that the outside of some interval from A to B, that test function is zero.
Okay, so not the Lorentzian then.
That's right, not the Lorentzian. So there have been different proofs of quantum inequalities for different sets of test functions, actually. And so the Lorentzian turns out to be a limiting case of the compactly supported test functions. You could take if you could take the proper limit, that's what you would get. Okay. Yes?
Am I right in understanding then that there's no limit to how negative the energy can be, as long as it's for over a small enough region.
Correct.
Okay.
So what the universe is basically saying is you can have negative energy, but you can only borrow a certain amount for a certain amount of time.
Right. Okay. Right.
So when you set the test function to 1, it's 0.
Yes, and so in that particular case, if you set the test function to 1, which I can't do with this expression, but I could do with the Lorentzian by taking tau 0, the width going to infinity, and what I recover is the averaged weak energy condition. All right. Now, people have done this for all sorts of different fields, and in Minkowski space, they're somewhat easier to work with, so I'll show you the massless scalar field. If you take your compactly supported test function and you calculate the quantum inequality, the functional on the right is just take the derivative of the test function, square it, and integrate. That gives you, that's in some way related to the width of the test function. In four-dimensional Minkowski space, you end up having the second derivative of the test function squared and then integrated. Okay. So quantum inequalities have been proven for all sorts of, so these are Minkowski space, they've been proven for quantum field theories and curved spacetimes as well. And people have gone after the scalar field with and without mass, the electromagnetic field, the Proca field, the Dirac field, P-form field theories, which is my new sort of topic of study nowadays, and spin 2 have been studied. Okay. All right. So what problem am I working on at the moment? Well, in 2011, Dan Solomon published two papers in Advanced Studies in Theoretical Physics. It's a journal out of Singapore. And what he had were two models of space-times in which he claims the quantum inequalities were violated. Now, up until this point, all quantum inequalities were done for free fields. So if you're looking for a research topic for future work, interacting field theories would be a good start. So there's no quantum inequalities for interacting field theories yet. But what Dan Solomon had was he looked at two-dimensional Minkowski space. And in this two-dimensional Minkowski space, he put a potential. So this is not quite a free field theory anymore. And the potential he looked at was had been studied by Mamev and Trunov in the past. And what they are is you have a delta function potential. And so here's a delta function, and these are barriers, so the constant in front of the delta function is positive. So these are like two potentials sticking up. Okay. And he then, at time t equals 0 in Minkowski space, switches them off. And so in the upper region, he then says, I can apply the flat space and the quantum inequalities to this model. And how does he show that these quantum inequalities are violated? Well, what he does is the following. He takes the vacuum energy for, let's talk about this space-time on the left. He takes this particular space-time, and Mamev and Trunov showed that in this space-time, that to the left of the delta functions and to the right of the delta function, the renormalized stress energy tensor for a massless scalar field vanishes. However, between the two delta function potentials, there is a non-zero Casimir energy, and it happens to be constant. And it's a negative constant in this case. And what Solomon argues is that because the wave equation at the t equals 0 Cauchy surface has to be continuous, and the first derivative in time has to be continuous, he then argues that the stress energy tensor needs to be continuous across this boundary. And so he propagates, well, not sort of propagates, he just puts the negative energy up into the upper half of Minkowski space, at which point he can now use the flat space quantum inequality. But he's made two errors. The first error is that the continuity of the wave equation does not guarantee continuity of the stress energy tensor across the T0 boundary. And the second error he makes is that the quantum inequalities are on energy differences. So you can't take the renormalized energy density, stick it in the quantum inequality, and expect the quantum inequality to hold. You have to take a difference between something. And so he proposed these two models, and I decided, well, oh, there's one other thing he forgets. What happens when a space-time, what happens to a quantum field theory when a space-time changes shape? It has to respond by particle creation. And so the switching off of the potential in this case has to generate a burst of particle creation at the T equals zero Cauchy surface. And so Solomon also forgot to include this burst of particles traveling outward from the locations of the two delta function potential points. Yes?
So can you give me a clear picture as to why the structure of space-time changes and the particles have to move? Is it geometry being converted to particles?
That's something I'm still weak on. An intuitive picture, I know the mathematical reasoning is that what you call positive frequency in the in region, so you have an e to the minus I omega t type mode, right? When the geometry of the space-time evolves, that e to the I omega t is no longer a pure mode in that space-time anymore. It has to evolve other frequency components. And those other frequency components end up being interpreted as exciting other energy eigenstates of the quantum system. It's about the best I can do.
Typically, particle content is observer-dependent, even in Minkowski space-time.
Yes.
You could have an accelerated observer that sees different particle content. So there's just no observer independent notion of what kind of particles there are, I guess. Does that have to do with that?
It's a related phenomenon, yes. Should I move on? Okay. So what model did I want to look at? Well, I was talking about p-form theories, and one of the things that I was studying in the p-form theories is when the topology is non-trivial. And I was stuck on how does one quantize a specific set of zero-frequency eigenmodes. And so I figured I'd take up this problem and I'd do it in a geometry where I could try to solve the other problem as well. So what I did is I decided to look at the two-dimensional space-time, which is a cylinder, a time-like cylinder. So time is the vertical axis, and I have a closed spatial dimension in the x direction. And so I'm going to label the x in sort of length scale type units going from 0 to L. And I then have a scalar field with a potential, and I used the type of potential that Mamev and Trunov had, and so I have two times a coupling constant, so my epsilon naught is just some coupling constant. It has units of 1/length. I then have my delta function potential at t equals zero, and I have a theta function which turns the potential off at time t equals zero. Okay. And so I do the same thing. I have, in the lower half space-time, I have to solve the wave equation with the potential. And this can actually be done analytically. In the out region, I have the traditional wave equation for the scalar field. And I match the solutions in exactly the same way. So basically what I'm doing is that I take a solution and sort of an eigenmode of the wave equation down here, and it propagates up to the t equals zero Cauchy surface. At the t equals zero Cauchy surface, I then use that as the initial data for the out region of this space-time. And I then calculate the Fourier coefficients. And so I just wanted to briefly show you what the different mode functions are for the different regions. So in the in region, there are your traditional sine functions going around, and they vanish at the location of the delta function. And so these odd, so to speak, symmetry modes have no interaction with the delta function whatsoever. The even frequency modes do have a non-zero value at the, the even symmetry modes do have a non-zero value at the location of the delta function, and because of the delta function, the potential there, they have a kink. So I have solutions with a kink here, and the solution to the wave equation is given over here. They are pure e to the I omega t type dependence in this case. However, the typical moment or inverse the moment of the k is 2 pi over n is replaced, and I get 2z over l. And the zj is now the jth root of a transcendental equation. Okay, so I have this transcendental equation which I have to solve, and then in addition there's a capital Aj which is the normalization condition or the normalization coefficient for that particular mode. And so these are the in-region eigenfunctions. How about, the transcendental equation is not that bad, actually. I have 1 over chi, and chi, it turns out, is a dimensionless variable. It's the coupling constant times L divided by 2. And so my eigenvalues for the even modes are not quite evenly spaced, but they're sort of pseudo-periodic. Okay. And the plot was done with specific values, and the zj's are sort of go as pi times j minus 1 plus some correction. Okay.
Can I ask a question?
Certainly.
Actually, two slides back.
Sure.
You say dt is continuous. Even at x equals 0, is that the location of the delta function? Or is that... Because you've got an infinite discontinuity. If I think about the time space, the delta function goes from being present to going away. That doesn't. I understand that you want the derivative under its continuous elsewhere, but what about the spot of the delta function?
It turns out when I. The way I've checked that was to plot what the in and the out solutions look like at the point. And the outgoing Fourier series actually preserves the kink, but the kink then moves outward at the speed of light to the left and to the
right. Show us the outgoing Fourier series?
Yes.
So I'll be quiet. Go ahead.
Okay. I'd really appreciate it. If there are issues, I'd like to know them before publishing. So, okay. So the out region eigenfunctions are your traditional sine and cosine. And so you have the positive frequency e to the I kx with the sine kn, or e to the I kt. And then there's the thing that I was trying to solve in the case of the p forms, but I can have them over here. When you work on a space-time that has compact spatial section, there's an additional zero frequency mode. And typically, in the Green's function for that space-time, what they do is they'll have a term A times a constant, or A plus BT. And that was what I was looking at, was there's two different solutions. There's a constant solution, and there's a time solution. a linear in time solution. The problem is when you try to put that in the symplectic form, the constant solution has no conjugate momenta. So what do you do with that when you second quantize? And then the other solution, the time solution, does have a conjugate momenta. And this confused me for quite a while until I was teaching undergraduates. And we were talking about rotations of bases. And I thought to myself, why not rotate the basis in this case? And so it turns out that there's a topological solution which can be written as the square root of L over 2L, 1 minus IT over L. And the second linearly independent solution is its complex conjugate. And so the two of them can then be used in the Green's function. The cost of doing this, though, is that there's a new fundamental constant in the theory, this script L. So I have this script L that's running around, and this has to somehow be determined experimentally outside of the theory. It's a new constant, so to speak. It turns out, in the end, none of the results for this particular model will depend on the script L. So I have positive and frequency modes, and then what I do is to match the functions across the boundary. Well, it turns out the odd modes are common to both spacetimes, and so there's no problem just extending the sine function across the whole spacetime. The even modes, though, have two different forms. There's an input form, which is what I showed you, and then there's an output form, which is given by a Fourier series. And the Fourier series coefficients I have as one of those backup slides, just in case someone wanted to know what they were. Did you want to see them? Okay. So I have a complete set of orthonormal basis vectors, and what I can do is I have my classical physics, I have a Hamiltonian formulation, and I have the real-valued phi, and it's canonically conjugate momentum, which is the time derivative. And in addition, I can define a fully anti-symmetric bilinear form, and these two things end up being a suitable symplectic phase space. And so I can second quantize this system. So when I second quantize this system, I promote the field to its self-adjoint operator. And so I end up with, it's a little bit unusual to do this, but I separate the odd mode annihilation and creation operators from the even mode annihilation and creation operators. And the annihilation and creation operators satisfy the typical commutator relationships that one would expect. And A and B commute, that's correct. Everything beyond these two are zero. Okay. And so this is basically a review slide. I have the traditional Hilbert space, the Fock space, to go along with the particle number for these. Okay. However, in two dimensions, and in the upper half of the space-time, I have a unitarily equivalent algebra of observables, or in terms of the field operator, in terms of the other set of eigenmodes. So these were the out eigenmodes. And in this case, I end up with three types. I have annihilation and creation operators for the topological modes, the zero momentum modes. And I have the out region I denote with a tilde over the top. So the without a tilde is in the in region, tilde's out region. And so I have my annihilation and creation operators for the topological modes, for the odd modes, and for the even modes. Which means I have two different things I can call the vacuum state in the out region. I have the vacuum state with respect to the in region, and I have the vacuum state with respect to these particular eigenfunctions. So I have a whole new set of states 0 tilde, 1 tilde, 2 tilde, et cetera, et cetera. There's some relationships between the second set of operators. The A tilde and A are brand new. The A tilde for the odd modes are actually the original set, but the B tildes are not the original B operators. Yes?
So why wasn't there a topological mode in the in region?
So the topological mode in the in region corresponds to ZJ. So what would become the topological mode in the limit of the here, I'll show this is the J equals 1 mode. Because of the delta function, it has to have a kink. And because of the kink, it means it has to have spatial variation. As C0 goes to 0, this goes up to being a constant. And so this particular mode, because of the spatial variation, has non-zero frequency. Okay. So in the quantum model here, I have my space-time, I have my potential. My potential turns off at t equals 0. And I have, in the in region, I have my field operators phi, and I have an in vacuum state, and I have my creation and annihilation operators. In the out region, I have a field operator in phi or a field operator in psi. I have two different candidates for vacuum states. And I have creation and annihilation operators times 2. Plus 2, actually, it's times 2 plus 2. And the operators and states between the two different representations are linked by the Bogle-Bov coefficients, but those are the Fourier coefficients in the series for the out region. And so I could just pick them right out of the Fourier series. And so how do we interpret this then as particle creation once I have these Bogle-Bov coefficients? Well, before t equals 0, I say, let the universe be in the vacuum state. But the universe is in the in-vacuum state originally. Using the Heisenberg picture, the operators evolve in time, while the state is time-independent. So the particle content in the out region is still the in-region vacuum state. However, the thing that an observer would call the true vacuum, and I put true in quotes because there's not really true vacuum in that case, would be the out region vacuum state. Okay. And since the in region vacuum state can be re-expressed as a superposition of the out region functions, I can calculate the number of particles created in all the different modes that the out region person would see. And so this is interpreted as particle creation due to the potential turning off. And the one nice thing is about this is that there are no odd mode particles ever created. They don't see the delta function at all. Okay. And so what do I end up with? Well, I have a delta function and a vacuum state here. And in the out region, I have a burst of particle creation that I calculate, and the particles take off, because it's a massless theory, at the speed of light, traveling in the plus x and in the minus x direction. And so the question is, what is the actual equation? Well, before I do that, I have to talk about the Casimir effect, because I need some reference state to discuss the quantum inequalities with respect to. Well, in this space-time, in the cylinder space-time down here, the renormalized stress energy tensor has the typical minus pi over 6 L squared Casimir energy that someone would expect from the cylinder spacetime. Okay, that one's well known. When you include the topological, And then, because of the delta function, that's modified a bit. So because of the potential, in this case, I get A, which is a constant, over L squared. So there's a second term of the same type of units. And the constant A depends on that dimensionless chi I was talking about earlier. But it's a sum of things that are squared, so it's always a positive function, and it's monotonically increasing in chi. So I have an energy density which permeates this whole lower half of the universe for the in vacuum state that's slightly less negative than the typical Casimir. Yes?
I don't remember the physical meaning of chi, but is there a particular value of chi where A is one half?
Is there a yes.
And what does chi mean?
Well, chi is the ratio of the coupling constant, or is the product of the coupling constant with the length, the circumference of the universe. Yeah.
So it's dimensionless coupling constant. That length is given, that's L.
Yes.
Because at about a half, the expectation value of Tu nu goes to zero.
Yes.
Once it's canceling pi over 6.
Right. And so there's actually only a range of chi for which the energy density, the renormalized energy density, is in this space-time is negative. That's right. So it's from zero to...
So it's small chi.
It's small chi. That's right. Now, if I do the same thing in the upper half plane, I want to talk about what is the Casimir energy in the out space-time region with respect to the out vacuum, and that has the same minus pi over 6 L squared, and the correction here for the topological modes is that there's a plus 1 over 4 LL. So there's some, until L is known, there's some ambiguity in the Casimir energy for the out region. Okay. But this is not what I want. What I want is this expectation value in the out region. And so that I went after. And the expression actually is not so bad. What makes it hard, though, is that starting out with the mode expansion, I ended up with a Fourier series for this thing. And the Fourier series was not convergent on the computer, if you plotted it out to some partial sum of it, which was indicating that the Fourier series was not the Fourier series of a function, but a distribution of some sort. And after beating on it with a humongous hammer for a long time, it turned out that what the distribution that was hiding in there was a delta function. And so I had to tease out the coefficients for the delta function. So in the out region, the renormalized expectation value of the stress energy tensor is again the normal Casimir energy you would expect. And then there's two constants, B minus C over L squared. And then we have the particles that are created, and the energy density for those particles is actually two delta function pulses traveling in the left and the right direction. And so here's the delta function traveling to the left, and there's the delta function traveling to the right. And you might ask, why is there a sum? Well, in the out region of the space-time, the particles travel from 0 to L, and then you have to sort of reset the thing because the particles keep spiraling around this universe, like an old-fashioned barber's pole sign, the red and white. So I have these, the sum is what's giving me that multiple periodicity. Okay. And so again, so there's the energy density terms, and these two terms are the fluxes, the momentum flux traveling to the left and to the right. And, a little bit. So beta of chi turns out to be b of chi turns out to be a positive constant. C is actually just chi over pi, and that's just the definition over there. And the nice thing is that even though I had in the process of trying to derive this expression, I had the topological modes in there with this unknown constant L, the energy density, the renormalized energy density in that region is actually independent of that value of L. And so, so now the question is, what about the classical energy conditions? Well, turns out every one of the classical energy conditions fails. And it fails whenever the constant B minus C is less than a half, basically. Okay, so that was the same condition we saw earlier with the A. Okay, and what I've plotted here is actually A is a function of chi, so to speak, in the green, and then B as a function of chi in the blue, and C as a function of chi in the red. And these were numerical calculations done in Mathematica. Now I calculate the 2 to the 13th terms in the summation to get good convergence for these. Yeah, I'm very good at bringing Mathematica to its knees. Okay. And so then the question was, what about the quantum inequality? So in the quantum inequality, what I wanted to do is I have to look at the difference between two energy densities. And so the quantum inequality was say, I can choose my in vacuum state expectation value in the out region. And from it, I'll subtract, in this case, the out vacuum definition. Okay. So if I do that, I calculate the quantum inequality along a world line of an observer in the R cross S1 spacetime. For the compactly supported test functions, I get this expression on the right. So I chose to do this for all inertial observers. So anybody who's traveling at constant speed around this spacetime. And the first term in all of this is a positive constant times a negative constant, that comes out in the difference, times the integral of the test function squared, which is a positive integral, minus some functional of the g. It turns out that whatever the functional of g is doesn't matter to the argument. It's worked out in detail in my paper, but it's something negative. Okay. So this q is something negative. Well, that leaves me with the task of having to calculate what the left-hand side is. Well, if I go back to the expression for the energy density, the energy density is negative term, positive term. Well, I have shown that B minus C is always greater than zero, analytically. Positive term, positive term. And so the only thing I'm worried about is what negative terms get left over when I take the difference between this and the Casimir energy in that space-time. And what I find is that the first term is the 1 plus v squared over 1 minus v squared, the same constant, times the same integral, plus entirely positive terms. So contrary to what Solomon had claimed, the quantum inequality on this space-time is actually satisfied. Okay. So what are my outstanding issues at the moment? Well, I have two horrible summations, two horrible infinite summations, which I call A and B. And if I go back to the picture, A is the green line and B is the blue line. And if I were to plot them on the same picture, they'd lie on top of one another. But they come from two very, very different sums, and so somehow it looks like that these two things should be equal to one another. Well, is there an intuitive reason why these two things should be equal to one another? Actually, there is. If A equals B, then what I have in this space-time going from time slice to time slice is that when the potential turns off, the total energy in the Cauchy surface just before the potential is turned off is equal to the total energy in the Cauchy surface just after the potential is turned off. So A equal to B, if I could prove it analytically, would prove conservation of energy inside the quantum field. So I'm hoping that's actually analytically true. And then the other thing is that if I go back to the picture of B minus C, it looks like B minus C is always negative. Is always less than pi over 6. I only know that's true out to CL 40. I haven't shown it for all possible values of C. I think this is actually the easier task to show that the bound exists. Okay. So my conclusions are I've determined complete sets of basis eigenfunctions for both the in and the out region. I have a model that I can second quantize, and this particular 1 plus IT over L is I can use in the p-form research I was working on as well. It solved that problem. I've calculated the renormalized stress energy tensor in the out region and shown that that does violate the classical energy conditions. But contrary to what Solomon says, the stress energy tensor actually does obey the world-line quantum inequalities. And so that's all I have for you, so thank you. More questions? Yes, Fred.
So I'm just thinking back to sort of other models of particle creation, which are like way back in my head. And so, you know, you have sort of Riddler space.
I guess this is related to accelerated observers,
yeah. So to speak. And, you know, so that's sort of used to model what's happening right near the horizon of a black hole, if
right.
I recall correctly. Whereas in this case, you've got the positive delta function, which I feel like, yeah, I'm not sure exactly how I'm supposed to physically interpret that. It almost feels like I would want a negative delta function for a black hole.
So I was wondering, is a positive delta function more natural than a negative? Or what happens when things go negative? Is everything crazy then? Or?
So the positive delta function can be interpreted as sort of the limit as a little rectangle, right? And in the case of the quantum field theory, what that means is that in this little region of space, the particle, which was massive everywhere else, has acquired a mass. Mm-hmm. Right? So then the question is, what happens when you make the delta function negative, right? Okay, so that interpretation of, well, what does the mass do then is kind of weak. But there's a second problem, is that if you make the coefficient psi 0 too negative, that as soon as you make it negative, you have these type of modes with the kink in them, plus there's an additional vacuum mode below. Okay, that vacuum mode is unstable. Once the potential gets too deep, that vacuum mode's unstable. And so in the quantum, when you go to second quantize, the system sort of is collapsing. You condense a condensate into the vacuum state that keeps growing.
Can you still have a renormalized stress energy tensor, or does that not exist?
I'd have to refer you to the Mamov and Trunov paper for the details of that. When I saw that and I was like, the vacuum state was unstable and Solomon was not doing that, I was like, okay, I can only fight so many mathematical difficulties at one time. Let me just make psi greater than zero. So, yes.
So two questions. One is to follow up on Fred's earlier question about why you only see the topological term on one side and not on the other. And if I understood correctly, you were saying that one of the modes, the mode that looks like this, turns into the topological mode.
Yes.
So I should not be thinking that your counting of modes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 turns into modes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 up here. 1 turns into 0, 2 turns into 1, 3 turns into 2, et cetera. Is that correct? Do they all map up that line?
So,
And I'll tell you, my second question has to do with the meaning of L, so I don't know if that's related to this or not.
the little L.
Okay. So the, let's go to the next. So remember I had J's for one summation when I was talking about the odd modes on the in region. I'm sorry, the even modes on the in region. But in the out region, I had N's. And so what happens is that the J equals 1 mode becomes the N equals 0 mode in that limit. And the J equals 2 mode then becomes the N equals 1 mode.
So you're not mixing up in a more complicated way than that.
Not when you take the limits of C going to 0, yes.
Okay. So then the other question is the script L, which is critical but has no meaning.
Yes.
And, right, it has to be there, but it then goes away. So do you have any thoughts about what that represents? Is it some kind of reparametrization constant that you can just, you know, switch to a new set of coordinates? I mean, you need it there, right? If L was equal to 0, I mean, in your final expression, you couldn't just take L equal to 0, because everything goes up. Take L equal to 1, I was, oh, L equals 1, I was fine. Right, so
that one, yes. Yes.
So, is it, but everything is independent of it, so is this just some kind of, is it choosing some kind of parameter normalization? Is it something that you can parameterize away? I just, there must be some reason that it has to be there along the way, but not in the end.
So this was looked at by Ford and one of his former graduate students. I can never pronounce her name. What they did in that case was they did something similar, is they looked at modes in a space-time where the mass was non-zero initially and then turned off. And in that case, what happens is that the number of topological modes that is created depends on the constant L. And what Ford says is that there's still a freedom left after specifying the state there's still a freedom left after specifying the content of the particle content of the theory for the time oscillatory modes that's left over, which leaves an ambiguity in the number of particles created in the topological mode. Now, I'm not sure I fully understand what he means by that, because when I look at the number of particles that are created, and then I look at if I specify a state of n topological modes excited, and then look at the expectation value for the number of particles created, which is just a dagger a, that doesn't have the L in it at all. So the ambiguity Ford is seeing is because the mass shuts off, the topological mode evolves, and it's only in that case that there's an ambiguity in the particle number. And I get the same thing. There's an ambiguity in the particle number in the out region for the number of topological modes. But what the physical constant means, I still haven't developed any intuition for. Yes, Bill.
That's a very naive question. So on this very slide here, how did you know to take, you need to take a difference, but how did you know to take that difference and not say the opposite difference, the tilde minus the untilde?
Why do the tilde minus the other tilde? Oh, okay. All right. The quantum inequalities in Chris Fuster rederove the quantum inequalities by a different method using microlocal analysis, right? And if you did that, if you swap the order, okay, then what would happen is that the functional on the right changes as well. It switches. Because it's based on, there really should be subscripted on this Q, there should be this reference state. That Q is reference state dependent.
Okay, got it.
All right. And so this Q term will be reference state dependent. And so when I do these things, that would fix the problem, or not fix the problem, but give me a new quantum inequality on the right, which should counteract the swapping of the two terms.
Okay, but the first term on the right-hand side doesn't change?
The first term on the right-hand side. Well, it probably would change because the sign here would be plus and plus now, and I took the difference the other way around. And so I'd have to find what terms in the remaining Q over here were negative, and these terms were now negative. So that the system, in a sense, self-corrects if you swap the order. And so the basic way to interpret this is that the quantum inequality tells you, if you can find what the lowest energy state is for the system, the quantum inequality tells you how much more negative you can get another state with respect to that, and for how long. So, and in most cases, the lowest energy state is that's convenient to work with is the ground state in that space-time. Mm-hmm. Because that has the Casimir energy of whatever value.
Right, but the zero is the ground state before t equals, the zero until the...
Is before.
State before.
Well, in this expression, this is the expectation value of the stress energy tensor on the out region for the in vacuum state.
Okay.
Yeah.
Got it. Okay. Now it makes sense.
Okay. So what time? So why don't we end this here? We can actually talk more to Mitch on a lunch another day. Thank you again.
Thank you.